it is Monday, May 25th, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. Iran says progress has been made in U.S. talks on ending the war and reopening the Strait of Hormuz, but insists no deal is imminent. More on that in News Briefing. On In Depth, we look at a KBS survey on voter sentiment in key battlegrounds, including Seoul, Busan and Daegu, ahead of the June 3rd local elections. As for sports roundup, we bring in two more football experts to preview the upcoming World Cup, Korea's chances, and the teams most likely to lift the trophy. And to mark Buddha's birthday, we speak with a Korean monk in the UK about Buddhism, meditation and monastic life today. Let's start Korea 24 right now. Iran has confirmed that it's working on a framework for a deal with the United States and that the two sides have narrowed their differences on many issues. However, it's denying reports that nuclear commitments are part of the proposed deal and says no deal is imminent. Here to discuss this story and other news of the day is KBS News editor Eileen Cahill. Hello, Eileen.
Hello, Alana.
Eileen, what's the latest on negotiations toward an agreement between the US and Iran?
Well, reports in the U.S. media say the United States and Iran have reached an agreement in principle, both on reopening the Strait of Hormuz and disposing of Iran's highly enriched uranium. That's according to the New York Times and CNN on Sunday. However, while Iran confirms that the two sides have developed a framework and have bridged the gaps on a number of discussion topics, it says nuclear issues aren't on the table at this point.
And what did the U.S. side say in this weekend's reports?
The Washington Post cited a senior U.S. administration official as saying the two countries have developed a memorandum of understanding framework to extend the existing ceasefire by 60 days while negotiations toward a permanent settlement continue. The U.S. side claims that under this proposal, Iran would reopen the Strait of Hormuz immediately upon signing and take steps to restore shipping traffic to pre-war levels within 30 days. It says Iran would also renounce any plans to develop nuclear weapons with its enriched uranium stockpile to be disposed of through a method agreed upon by both sides. But Iran disputes that, saying it's working on the deal, but the signing still isn't that close and that nuclear issues won't be dealt with in the memorandum of understanding. And the memorandum still requires approval, both from U.S. President Donald Trump and Iranian Supreme Leader Mojtaba Khamenei.
We also have more news about the recent Tank Day campaign to promote Starbucks tumblers last week on the anniversary of the May 18th Gwangju Democratization Movement. I understand that the public's outrage over this case is still going strong. What can you tell us?
Well, Jong Yong-jin, chairman of Shinsegae Group, which licenses and operates Starbucks Korea, plans to apologize in person for the marketing campaign. As listeners may remember, Starbucks Korea used slogans such as Tank Day to promote its Tank Tumblr series last Monday, prompting a public outcry considering the timing. Of course, May 18, 1980 is when pro-democracy protesters in Gwangju stood up to the government in what South Koreans now remember as the Gwangju Democratic Uprising. The dictatorial government of then-President Chun Doo-hwan used tanks and helicopters to brutally suppress the protesters. After the campaign invited outrage, Jung issued a statement on Tuesday last week, apologizing for what he called an inappropriate marketing campaign that never should have happened, and he acknowledged the pain it caused to the victims of the massacre and to their families and the people of South Korea. This Tuesday morning, he intends to apologize again at a news conference at the Joseon Palace. This is a Gangnam area hotel, according to Shinsegae Group. He's also going to announce the results of an internal review of the Starbucks promotional event.
And Eileen, there's also a police investigation, isn't there?
That's right. Five people have lodged police complaints against Jung and some of the others involved in this marketing campaign, notably former Starbucks Korea CEO Son Jong-hyun, accusing them of defamation and violating the May 18th special act. The complaint was filed Wednesday of last week, and investigators are now questioning additional complainants at the Gwangju Nambu police station in South Jeolla province. According to the Public Crime Investigation Unit at the Seoul Metropolitan Police Agency, these people include Park Ha-sung, a person recognized for his distinguished service during the May 18th Gwangju Democratic Uprising in 1980.
The Starbucks campaign has generated so much anger that it's actually spilled over into the election campaigns. With just 9 days left until voters head to the polls, how are politicians making use of the tank day situation?
Well, in the run-up to June 3rd, both the ruling and main opposition parties are rallying support and hoping to prompt shy supporters to help to head to the polls and help them win. And the ruling Democratic Party seems to think the Starbucks campaign will do that. As listeners may be aware, President Lee Jae-myung and the ruling party have repeatedly slammed Starbucks Korea for the Tank Day fiasco. Jung Chung-rae, the co-chair of the party's election committee, has ordered candidates and campaign staff to refrain from frequenting the coffee chain and proposed a bill to punish anyone who belittles or mocks the May 18th movement.
And Eileen, how is the opposition responding?
The main opposition, People Power Party, has accused President Lee and the ruling party of scapegoating Starbucks in an attempt to divert voters' attention from Democratic Party candidates' flaws. Jang Dong-hyuk, chairman of the People Power Party's election committee, said the Democratic Party seems to have chosen Starbucks as a battle cry for this election. And in response, he actually suggested that voters go to polling stations with cups of Starbucks coffee in their hand.
Can you remind listeners how many seats are up for grabs in these elections and how many candidates are running?
Yes, a total of 54 candidates are vying for 16 posts as metropolitan mayors or provincial governors. And there are 585 candidates for the 227 seats to head lower-level administrative districts.
Well, on this holiday weekend, President Lee Jae-myung took part in an event to commemorate Buddha's birthday. Eileen, what were the highlights of his Buddha's birthday speech at the Jogye Temple on Sunday?
In his speech, President Lee Jae-myung promised to do his utmost to build a government that protects the people and said his government would take the Buddhist teachings as its guiding light.
And more specifically, how will he put those teachings into practice?
He emphasized the need to look out for all the country's citizens and especially for its vulnerable members. He said Buddhist teachings have helped Koreans through joys and hardships, guiding the nation through crises and encouraging people to embrace those who've been marginalized. He also drew attention to the Buddha's emphasis on understanding and harmony rather than exclusion and conflict, saying that message is a strong foundation for a more unified society. He cited the Buddhist words that hatred does not disappear through hatred, but only through compassion. And he said South Korea urgently needs a spirit of consideration, understanding, coexistence, and mutual prosperity amid deep social division.
And let's wrap up today with the weather. Eileen, give us the forecast.
Cloudy skies will give way to heavy rain in the southernmost part of Jeju Island and coastal areas south of the Korean Peninsula late Monday. Downpours will spread nationwide Tuesday with up to 300 millimeters of precipitation expected on Jeju and up to 200 millimeters in the southern coastal areas of South Gyeongsang Province through Wednesday. Seoul and the surrounding areas will likely see rainfall ranging between 30 and 100 millimeters with up to 80 millimeters expected in Daegu, Gangwon Province and the Chungcheong Provinces. Tuesday morning lows will range between 17 and 21 degrees Celsius, about 2 to 5 degrees higher than Monday's, with Seoul posting a low of 21 degrees. And afternoon highs will peak between 21 and 25 degrees, 3 to 5 degrees higher than the previous day.
And that's all we have for today's news briefing. Thanks so much, Eileen, for bringing us all the headlines.
Thank you for having me.
Hello, my name is Anna Yates Liu, assistant professor from the Department of Korean Music at Seoul National University. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
The June 3rd local elections and National Assembly by-elections are just 9 days away, and early voting will be held this Friday and Saturday. KBS commissioned two polling agencies to survey voter sentiment in the key battlegrounds, including Seoul, Busan and Daegu, just ahead of the official campaign period. The Democratic Party candidate was ahead in both Seoul and Busan outside of the margin of error, but the race has tightened significantly in Daegu, where the DP and People Power Party candidates are now in a neck-and-neck race. Today, we've invited Professor Hannah Kim of Sogang University's Graduate School of International Studies to pick apart the KBS poll and get a tune of where the election is headed. Hello, Professor Kim. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Professor, let's begin with the Seoul mayoral election, which immediately catapults the winner to a presidential contender. Tell us, who currently has the upper hand?
Right. So the Democratic Party's Chung Won-oh currently holds the upper hand with 45%, which is quite high compared to the 34% for the People Power Party's Oh Se-un, which is an 11 gap. And what's particularly telling about this is how each candidate relates to their own party's base. Chung Won-oh's support closely mirrors the Democratic Party's overall approval rating in Seoul, meaning that he's consolidating his base effectively, but not doing much beyond that. Oh Se-un, on the other hand, is polling about 10 points above his own party's approval rating in the city, which tells us he has genuine cross-party appeal and is likely drawing in moderate and independent voters who may not identify with the PPP, but are comfortable with him personally. So that's a meaningful asset. Mm-hmm. But still, with roughly 20% of voters still undecided and the stakes of this race extending well beyond City Hall, neither candidate can afford to be complacent.
Professor, as you mentioned, this is one of the key races. There's a lot at stake. What are some of the key issues that will decide this race?
So there are several major battlegrounds in this race. For example, housing and real estate is one of the most significant issues. Now, Seoul's rising apartment prices have made housing supply the defining issue of this election. And both candidates have opened their official campaigns by pledging to fast-track redevelopment and reconstruction projects, with the property sentiment of approximately 360,000 residents living in 472 redevelopment districts emerging as a key variable. Oh Se-un is leaning heavily into this issue, and he has unveiled a Seoul My Home plan that would allow young people to purchase a home jointly with the Seoul Housing and Communities Corporation by paying only 20% of the home price. He's also been attacking the current administration over what he describes as policies that have suppressed housing supply and hurt renters in the Jeonse market. And Chung Won-oh, meanwhile, has been pushing back, accusing Oh Se-un of trying to make this election entirely about real estate. So this does seem to be one of the key issues. But another major issue is the GTXA rebar omission scandal. Chung Won-oh has taken direct aim at rebar omission incident at Samsung Station on the GTXA line, calling it a disaster caused by Mayor Oh's safety insensitivity. And President Lee Jae-myung has since ordered relevant ministries to investigate this incident, which prompted immediate pushback from Oh Se-un's camp. And Oh Se-un wrote on Facebook that the president has stepped in directly and accused the government of running a government-influenced election. So this issue has now escalated beyond the local safety concern into a broader argument about whether the central government is interfering in a municipal race.
Well, I think it will come as no surprise to our listeners to hear that housing is such a huge issue for Seoul voters, given how many times we've discussed the topic here on Korea 24. Just as important as where the candidates stand now is, of course, where this race is headed. So KBS has conducted three polls over the past month. Professor Kim, how have the numbers shifted over that period?
You know, what's really surprising and remarkable is that it hasn't really changed at all. Now, the gap between the two candidates has held at exactly 11 percentage points across all three surveys conducted over the past month. And that kind of consistency is actually quite significant in a very volatile political environment. It suggests the race has reached a stable equilibrium. Neither candidate is gaining momentum at the other's expense, and no external event has been powerful enough to disrupt the fundamental alignment of voters. So in election analyses, a flat trend line over multiple polls is often more informative than a moving one, because it tells you the race has found its natural level and that changing the outcome will require something genuinely disruptive in the final stretch.
Well, let's now move to South Korea's second largest city, the southern port city of Busan. And Professor, who are the candidates there and what is the latest poll showing?
So in Busan, the contest is between the Democratic Party's Chun Jae-su and the People Power Party's incumbent mayor, Park Hyung-jun. And the latest poll puts Chun Jae-su at 45% and Park Hyung-jun at 34%. Again, this is an 11-point Democratic lead, which is a striking parallel to the Seoul numbers. And it's worth noting that Park is an incumbent, which typically provides a structural advantage in local races. Yet he's still trailing by double digits. And that suggests voter dissatisfaction is cutting through whatever incumbency benefit he might otherwise enjoy. And as we've seen across the board in this election cycle, approximately 20% of Busan voters remain undecided, which is keeping the race from being called definitively and leaving real uncertainty heading into election day.
What are some of the major issues driving voter sentiment in Busan?
So the Busan race is being fought on two distinct levels, local policy and national politics, and both are shaping voter sentiment. So on the local policy front, the central clash is over the city's economic direction. Now, Democratic candidate Chun Jae-su argues that Busan's economy has entered a phase of structural recession and is calling for industrial restructuring and a shift in growth strategy, while incumbent Park Hyung-jun counters that Busan is clearly changing, pointing to the achievements of his current administration. And this debate over whether Busan is in decline or recovery cuts directly to voters' lived experiences. Beyond the economic debate, Chun has put forward 100-day emergency livelihood measures, which is pledging a full review of major infrastructure project budgets to direct funds towards stabilizing daily life, including fuel subsidies for small freight drivers, energy vouchers for small business owners, and expanded cashback programs for the local currency. So it's a clear livelihood versus landmark projects frame. And this is resonating with working class voters in the city. And at the national level, two competing narratives are colliding directly in Busan. The Democratic side is campaigning on rooting out the remnants of the insurrection, essentially asking voters to deliver a further verdict on the forces associated with former President Yoon's martial law attempt. And the PPP's counteroffensive has centered on what is called the special counsel bill controversy, where the PPP argues that the DP's special counsel bill is effectively legislation designed to allow the withdrawal of prosecutorial cases involving President Lee Jae-myung himself. So in many ways, these two issues are now shaping voter sentiment there.
And Professor, what can the polling trends tell us about what we're seeing in Busan?
So the trend in Busan is one of the more stable and consistent stories in this entire election cycle, that the Democratic lead has held for five consecutive weeks. That's not a one-poll snapshot. That's a sustained pattern. What has shifted, however, is the undecided poll. Mm-hmm. It's been gradually shrinking over the course of these 5 weeks, suggesting voters are making up their minds as election day approaches. But what's crucial is that those decisions haven't dramatically altered the gap between the two candidates, which means the voters breaking from the undecided appear to be distributing fairly evenly or slightly favoring the existing leader. So if Chun continues to hold this margin through election day, Busan will be a Democratic pickup of a major city, which would carry significant implications for the national political narrative going forward.
And Professor, you mentioned that some 20% of voters are still undecided. So it sounds like that race, there's still a lot to play for. We'll look now to our third city, which is, of course, Daegu. This is the main city in the North Gyeongsang region. How is the race unfolding there?
Yeah, so Daegu is the real nail biter of this entire election, and frankly, the most politically symbolic race on the map. Now, the DP's Kim Bu-kyum sits at 40%, and the PPP's Choo Kyung-ho is at 39%, which is a statistical dead heat that falls well within the 3.5-point margin of error. So to put that in context, Daegu is the heartland of Korean conservatism, a city that has voted overwhelmingly for right-leaning parties for decades. And the fact that a Democratic candidate is in a dead heat here is by itself a headline. And on the trend, Kim's support has been essentially flat across the last two surveys. He appears to have plateaued in a fairly narrow band, while Choo has steadily closed in on this gap. So the momentum is on the PPP side, but it remains to be seen whether Choo can close that final sliver by election day. And there's an interesting divergence in perception. So when voters were asked not who they support, but who they think will win, Choo leads with from 49 to 39, again within the margin of error, but a reversal of the support numbers. And with 20% still undecided and with government oversight sentiment rising, even in this conservative stronghold, Daegu is genuinely anyone's race. And the result here may well define also the broader narrative of this election.
Right. And just a reminder for our listeners that Daegu is historically a very conservative region. So again, to have a DP contender in the lead, it really, as you said, Professor, is quite headline news. And just some added context, these surveys on mayoral races, they're conducted by Hanguk Research on 800 adults in each city from May 16th to 20th. They had 95% confidence level and a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. We now move to the Western Jeolla region, specifically to the gubernatorial race in North Jeolla province, which has become one of the fiercest battlegrounds in this election, with the incumbent governor running as an independent. What are voters saying at this point?
I think you mentioned this as well, but you know, North Jeolla has become one of the most fascinating and unconventional races in this election. The DP's Lee Won-taek sits at 39%, while independent incumbent Kim Kwan-young is at 37%, well within the margin of error, making this a genuine toss-up. And what makes this race so analytically interesting is the underlying motivation of voters. When they're asked what drives their candidate choice, 68% of respondents cited the person, the individual's character, track record, and leadership, while only 29% cited party affiliation. So that's a striking inversion of how Korean elections typically function in the Jeolla province, where party label often determines everything. And the fact that personal credibility is outweighing partisan loyalty in one of the Democratic Party's traditional strongholds speaks volumes about the unique dynamic Kim has created by running as an independent and about infighting within the DP.
Professor, as you just mentioned, this was a region where the party label meant almost everything. So running as an independent is quite rare in South Korean politics. Can you give us a bit more information about that?
Yeah, so Governor Kim Kwan-young made the decision to break from the DP and run on his own. And polling suggests it may prove to have been a shrewd political gamble. The most telling data point is that even among self-identified Democratic voters in North Jeolla, 37% say they will still vote for the independent Kim over their own party's official candidate. And that level of cross-partisan personal loyalty is extraordinary in the Korean context because Kim is essentially running a campaign built entirely on his personal record and relationship with voters rather than on the machinery of a major party. But what makes this story complicated is that Kim didn't simply choose to leave. He was expelled from the Democratic Party over allegations that he distributed cash envelopes at a drinking gathering with young party members, mm-hmm. with closed-circuit television footage of the incident being made public. So Kim acknowledged that handing out approximately 1 million won in cash under the pretext of designated driver fees, but he also maintained that the money was returned the very next day. And he had challenged the expulsion in court, but the Seoul Southern District Court dismissed the injunction, ruling that it was difficult to conclude the party's action was procedurally unlawful or excessively harsh. So it becomes a story that's less about a politician making a bold strategic choice and more of one of an incumbent governor who was pushed out and is now betting that voters in his home province will judge him on his record rather than the party's verdict.
Mm-hmm. And that survey that you mentioned was conducted by Embrain Public on 810 adults from May 18th to the 20th. It had a 95% confidence level and a margin of error of plus or minus 3.4 percentage points. Now on to our final destination, South Chungcheong province, which lies in the centre of the nation. Professor, how's the race unfolding up to this point there?
So South Chungcheong has produced arguably the most dramatic shift of any race we've discussed so far, and it deserves a bit of careful unpacking. Now, a month ago, Democratic candidate Park Soo-yeon led PPP's Kim Tae-hoon by a commanding 21 percentage points, the kind of lead that would typically signal a race is almost over before it even begins. But the latest poll shows Park at 41% and Kim at 37%, which is a gap of just 4 points. So Kim has gained over 10 percentage points in a single month, and that is a seismic shift by any standard, and it transforms South Chungcheong from what looked like a safe democratic hold into a genuine battleground. But that being said, there are important structural reasons to believe Park retains an advantage. Among voters who said they will definitely vote, Park leads 47-40. Which is a 7-point gap that pushes back outside the margin of error. And this suggests his support is more enthusiastic and reliable. And when voters were asked not who they support, but who they think will actually win, Park leads 44-30, which is a 14-point gap that points to a significant perceived electability advantage. In election dynamics, perceived electability can become a self-fulfilling prophecy by encouraging supporters to turn out. So while the momentum clearly belongs to Kim right now, the ground game, turnout operation, and closing message will ultimately determine whether that surge translates into a victory or falls just short.
Mm-hmm. And that survey was conducted by Hankook Research on 800 adults from May 16th to 20th and had a 95% confidence level and a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. And finally, Professor, before I let you go, what should we be looking out for as we're about to enter the polling blackout period on Thursday? Now, this is, of course, for listeners, when new survey results cannot be published. Are there any last minute variables that could shift the race?
Yeah, so as we enter this blackout period, I'd flag a few things to watch closely. The first and most fundamental is turnout. In virtually every race we've covered so far today, the undecided bloc equals or exceeds the margin between the candidates. And this election will not be decided by persuasion at this point. It will be decided by mobilization. So whichever campaign gets its voters to the polls more effectively wins. And that's especially true in the tighter races like Daegu and South Chungcheong. And in addition to that, another second variable and one that could be decisive in the final hours is candidate consolidation. Now, in Korean politics, last-minute withdrawals and mergers between candidates from the similar ideological camp are a well-established tradition. And this election is no exception. In the Busan parliamentary by-election, running alongside the mayoral race, voices within the PPP are increasingly calling for conservative candidate unification, with independent candidate Han Dong-un and the Democratic Party's Ha Jong-woo locked in a statistical dead heat. And this raises fears that a split conservative vote could hand the seat to the Democrats. And in Daegu, polling experts have long noted that conservative votes there have been historically consolidated at the last minute, which is a pattern that could once again narrow what looks like a dead heat in the final stretch. So whether that consolidation happens and how quickly may well determine the outcome in the two most competitive races on the map.
And as you said, Professor, still a lot of undecided voters out there, which make for very exciting races and a lot to play for. That's all we have time for today. Our many, many thanks to Professor Hannah Kim of Sogang University's Graduate School of International Studies for helping us break down the latest KBS polling and the key races to watch ahead of early voting this week. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Kim.
Thank you for having me.
Hello, I'm violinist Clara Jimmy Kang. You're now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
The 26th FIFA World Cup is now just weeks away, and South Korea, making their 11th consecutive appearance, have confirmed their squad and arrived in North America. Hong Myung-bo's side will open against Czechia in Guadalajara at 11 a.m. Korea time on June 12th, before facing host nation Mexico and South Africa in the group stage. So now that we know the roster and the draw, the real debate begins. How far can the Daegu Warriors go and who will lift the trophy? A few weeks ago, experts Yoo Ji-ho and John Dorden predicted Korea would reach the round of 32. But with the final squad now set, there's plenty more to discuss. So in lieu of today's sports roundup, we're going to do just that with two guests. First on the line is sports writer Stephen Price. Great to have you with us, Mr. Price.
Great to be back on.
And on the line from the US is Steve Han, who writes for FIFA.com. Welcome to the show, Mr. Han.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
Well, let's begin with the scale of this World Cup itself. It is the biggest tournament in the sport's history. Mr. Han, as I mentioned, you're joining us from the US. You're in Los Angeles, one of the host cities. With kickoff now just weeks away, tell us, what is the atmosphere like? Is the World Cup buzz really starting to build?
Yeah, I think little by little, the excitement is building. I mean, we still hear a lot about how the reception has been a little bit underwhelming so far compared to the expectations. But I could, you know, being here locally, I could sense the sort of, you know, the excitement that people have. And, you know, I just think that one common theme for a lot of teams, if not all teams, is there's a lot of uncertainty right now, you know, both on and off the pitch, really, because, you know, just the fact that it's a 48-team tournament for the first time ever. And it's also being co-hosted in three different countries for the first time as well. So, you know, not only is there an additional round of 32 game after the group stage, like you said, you know, the amount of traveling and the climate in North America and all of these things make the World Cup, you know, it drastically different compared to the one we had in Qatar 4 years ago.
Right. As you just mentioned, lots of firsts for this World Cup. The first time that 48 teams will be competing and the first time it will be hosted across three nations. Let's now turn from the atmosphere around the tournament to the team
Korea is actually bringing into it. The final 26-man roster has been confirmed. The squad has already departed for their pre-camp in Salt Lake City in Utah. Mr. Price, remind our listeners about Hong's selection. How did you read it and were there any surprises?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there will be many surprises in the Korean squad at all. I think the only surprise for me was how early it was announced. At the time of speaking, there's several teams that haven't even announced their squads yet. So Korea's really getting over there as early as they can to give themselves that little bit of extra preparation time. And yeah, there's a bit of debate around maybe some of the players on the fringes of the squad, but I think there weren't any real big surprises. Looking at the kind of recent games over the last 6 or 9 months, it seems Hong Wangbo likes to play with this three at the back. So I think we might be seeing that again in the World Cup. The only problem is, there's two centre-backs, I think, Kim Min-jae, obviously, and Lee Han-bom, who are kind of locked on. But then the other centre-back, it's not quite clear who that's going to be. And so that's going to be an area to kind of watch out for in the friendlies to see who he picks there. And then up front, I think we're going to have probably Oh Hyun-gu up top. He's had a great season. He's actually played for two teams, Genk in Belgium and Besiktas in Turkey. But he's managed 18 goals and 7 assists for like those two combined over the season. He's had a good year. So I think he'll start up top with Lee Gang-in and Son Heung-min as the two either side of him. Probably in like a kind of 3-4-3 formation. So that's what we can expect to see from South Korea going into the World Cup. But of course, we'll know more when we see these kind of upcoming friendlies to see how Hong wants to play it.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Price, are there any injury concerns or fitness issues we should be keeping a watch out for?
Yeah, I mean, the big injury concern to look out for is Hwang In-bom, who he's had such an unlucky season. He's been in and out with injuries, and he's such a key player. He's in probably the five most important players in his Korean team. But all season he's been hampered with injuries and he's been injured again. I mean, reports are that he's on the training ground now, kicking a ball and stuff. So hopefully he'll be fully fit for that first game. It sounds like, unless there's any setbacks, he probably will. But that's been the big concern, the big thing for people to really look out for. There's been a few other minor knocks, but it seems that generally most players are quite fit. My real concern is more about the form that the players are coming into this tournament. Mm-hmm. Back in 2022, most players were on form when they were coming into the tournament. They had really great seasons. But this season, it feels like nobody's had a good season. Lee Gang-in's hardly played. Kim Min-jae's hardly played. They've both played about 2,000 minutes. But all like just off the bench and things like that. So that's two of Korea's key players who are not playing as regularly as they'd like to. And then, of course, yeah, Son Heung-min's not quite in his prime anymore. And there seems to be a few issues about where his recent managers have decided to play him, not in his strongest position and things like that. So it'd be nice to see those players coming into the World Cup on form. So that's, to me, a bit of a worry coming into this World Cup.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to put you both on the spot now and ask the big question. With the expanded 48-team format and the new round of 32, what's a realistic target for South Korea? Mr. Price, I'll start with you. How far do you think that they can go in this World Cup?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because there's no optimism at all around here about the team. Nobody seems to be expecting them to do well, but because of the format and because of the way the draw has gone, Korea actually have quite a good chance of going quite a long way in the tournament. You look at the group they're in, compare it to previous ones. There's Mexico, who they've got the host advantage, but Korea drew with them last time they played last year, and they seem to be having a bit of a crisis themselves at the moment. And they're the strongest team in the group. And then Czech Republic and South Africa, you'd think Korea should be able to get results, if not wins, in those games. So you'd expect them to probably get through the group. And let's say they come second and Mexico come top of the group. I think Korea could, if they do really well, they could win the group. But let's say they come second, then they'll be playing a team that comes second in Group B, which is a very weak group. So that's probably going to be like Canada or Bosnia in the next round. And you think Korea could probably get through that. So that takes you to, I think, we'll be the round of 16. So I would predict the round of 16. But then maybe there's a bit of momentum. If they get that far in the round of 16, they'll probably face either Japan or the Netherlands, which are still good teams, but they're not France or Brazil or someone. And I'm sure Steve Hann will be very excited because that match will be in his hometown in Los Angeles. So he'll be getting straight to the game, getting a ticket to watch those games for sure.
Well, as you said, I've also heard a lot of scepticism. So it's great to hear a bit more of a positive prediction. Mr. Hann, let me put the same question to you. What do you think is a realistic target for South Korea and how far do you think they can go?
Yeah, it's this is such a no fun answer, but no one really knows with this team. It's so hard especially with the way this team has been constructed. We certainly know that, just like Steve just said, we certainly know that they have the potential, you know, and for all of the criticisms on the KFA and Hong Myung Bo, you know, there were games last year, just like what Steve said, against the likes of US, against the likes of Mexico and a few others that Korea looked pretty strong against. And you take into account that this team also is not just about Son Heung-min, you know, who in all fairness is one of the better players in the world still. But, you know, also the likes of, you know, Lee Kang-in, Kim Min-jae, it's not just about them. You know, this is a generation of players who saw Korea get to the World Cup semifinal in 2002. You know, they saw Korea win an Olympic medal. They grew up watching the Premier League and the Champions League football. And they really grew up with the belief that Korea can be good at football. And I'm not even that old, but, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Korea, I had no idea what the Champions League was. And I didn't really until I got to, like, middle school. So, you know, you take all that into consideration. You know, this is a team that should be, you know, competing for wins in the knockout stage with at least, you know, a chance to win one game, one knockout game in the World Cup, I feel like. So, you know, anything less than the round of 16 would be a disappointment for Korea. But, you know, really, this team should be contending for a place in the quarterfinals, in my opinion.
Well, last time we had our previous experts on, their prediction was round of 32. So wonderful to hear you both say that they could go a bit further to the round of 16. Let's turn to the race for the trophy. Only 8 countries have ever won the World Cup. That's Brazil, Germany, Italy, Argentina, France, Uruguay, England and Spain. France and Spain are currently among the favourites. England's close behind. But does the North American setting, you know, change the equation at all with the travel, altitude, climate, of course, crowds? Mr. Hann, if you had to pick a winner of this World Cup, who would you pick and why?
I'm going to go with a team that I've actually never picked to win a major tournament in the past. And I hope I'm not jinxing this, you know, for our friend here, Steve Price. This is more my feeling than an objective take, to be honest, but I'm going to go with England. And you know, make no mistake, they did not look great in recent friendlies. In fact, they lost to Japan in March. But, you know, this is a team that has made some really big strides on the international stage under Gareth Southgate until a few years ago. But the issue has been that they couldn't get over the final hurdle. Like, you know, the 2 straight Euro finals and also the World Cup semifinal in 2018. But, you know, with Thomas Tuchel in charge now, this is a manager who, you know, not only builds winning teams, but he really excels at winning one-off games, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you take a look at what he did to win the Champions League with Chelsea and just his flexible, you know, his flexibility tactically to make those timely adjustments. And I think they have a manager in place now, England, who can take them to the promised land. And they've also got the likes of Harry Kane, who, in my opinion, is the best striker in the world. And, you know, they've got a really strong unit behind them under Thomas Tuchel. And I just think this is their time now.
I don't think that's too wild of a prediction. As I mentioned, they are, you know, among the favourites to take home the trophy. But Mr. Hann, are there any dark horses or teams that are being totally overlooked that you think could make at least a bit of a good run in this tournament?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say this as a Korean, you know, because I'm a fan before I'm a journalist, obviously. And I hate to say this, but I want to mention Japan for a reason that's beyond what they've been shown on the pitch, to be honest. They've been really good, but aside from that, you know, Mitoma and Minamino are two key players that are out with injuries for this World Cup. And perhaps even their captain, Wataru Endo, he may not be fit. You know, but they don't seem to be fazed by that. I feel like if Korea was missing, you know, Son Heung-min, Lee Kang-in, and Hwang In-beom, it would really be doom and gloom for Korea. But the fact that they believe in their own depth to cover for those injuries, and seeing their legendary former players like, you know, Shunsuke Nakamura and, you know, Makoto Hasebe, you know, willingly joining the national team coaching staff, it tells me that, you know, this is a team that's rallying behind one common goal, and that's achieving unprecedented success in Japanese football. And objectively speaking, I think this is a team that, you know, has the ability to go far even with those injuries.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Price, I'll come to you. As a proud Englishman, I'm sure you're thrilled to hear Mr. Han's prediction. But I do want to know, who's your pick to win the World Cup? Is there a team that you think maybe people are underestimating? Do you agree with Mr. Han and think that football's coming home?
Yeah, I think it's probably more difficult to predict than in the past because of that extra knockout round. So, if it's a league, then the best team normally wins it. But with that extra knockout round, there's that extra bit of randomness, which, you know, probably makes it a bit harder to predict. But the way FIFA have made the tournament is they've got the four kind of strongest ranked teams. So that's France, Spain, England and Argentina. They can't meet each other until the semifinals. I feel England have like the best chance in a long time. Harry Kane is the best, as we said, best goal scorer in Europe. He scored 58 goals this season. That's crazy. But Thomas Tuchel has also sorted out the problems that they had in the past. He's not trying to put round pegs in square holes or anything like that. So the team's got a good balance, and I think that's going to help. The only problem England have is that if the draw kind of goes as predicted, if the teams that look like they'll win their group, then England have a very tough run. In the first knockout round, they'll probably be going to Mexico in Mexico. So you've got horrible away atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they win, they'll probably be playing Brazil in the quarterfinals, which is probably the toughest quarterfinals that they could get. So that might not help with... Yeah, you've got so many games. But apart from that, I'm feeling pretty confident that maybe this will be England's year, finally.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, I think it sounds like the tournament is wide open for a lot of teams, so it'll certainly make for an exciting one for fans. Before we wrap up, and before the tournament begins, South Korea are going to be playing two warm-up friendlies in Utah, where they're currently training against Trinidad and Tobago and El Salvador. Mr. Price, when it comes to these matches, you know, what should we be watching for? Is it fitness, tactics, the starting lineup, or something else?
Yeah, I mean, Trinidad and Tobago, in the past, they had some great players, guys like Dwight York, for example, in their teams. But these two matches, like North America's like the weakest of the qualification groups. And if you're a North American country, it wasn't particularly hard to get to the World Cup. And both of these countries failed to do that. They don't. Yeah, it kind of shows how maybe weak they are at the moment. So if South Korea took these matches 100% seriously and went for it, they'd win both of them, you'd imagine. I'd imagine instead of that, though, perhaps they're going to be working on some tactics, working on some kind of passing patterns and things like that, so that all the players kind of know what they're doing. So really taking these like training games rather than going out for the win or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'd expect to see, kind of seeing, especially in terms of who's going to play in that three in defence, kind of sorting out like those kind of tactics and things in these games.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd say for somebody watching it, it's probably not going to be the most exciting games.
Right. It makes sense that, you know, no one wants to get an injury in a friendly. But we'll be watching those warm-up friendlies very closely as kickoff draws near. My thanks to Stephen Price for joining us today. Thank you so much, Mr. Price.
Yeah, thanks.
And Steve Han, thank you so much for your insights.
Thanks for having me.
Today is a national holiday in South Korea. as the country marks Buddha's birthday, a day that follows the lunar calendar and is celebrated with temple visits, lantern displays, and the colourful Lotus Lantern Festival. Buddhism is the second most popular religion in Korea and is growing in popularity with a notable rise among younger generations. And the holiday remains one of the country's most recognizable traditions, offering a moment to pause, reflect, and think about the role of Buddhism that still plays in everyday Korean life. To mark the occasion, we're speaking with a Korean monk based in the UK who has spent years teaching Zen meditation, leading retreats, and introducing people to the Buddhist practice and monastic life. It's my pleasure to welcome Jisoo Sunim of the Hyunwasa Temple in Kingston upon Thames. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jisoo Sunim.
It's a very kind of you having me.
Well, to begin, Jisoo Sunim, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you became a monk and how your path eventually led you to the UK?
I made myself a Buddhist monk in 1978 in a beautiful mountain temple in southeast part of South Korea called Pagesa Palgongsan. The teaching of Buddha's way of self-reliance, independence, self-mastery might be main reason for myself, who were rather rebellious and eccentric and a bit arrogant from time to time, making a trouble in the school, in the family occasion, etc. And then when I happened to be spending a few days in temple, so that's why I made myself a Buddhist monastery. And then, you know, I came to the UK 2008. Since then, I've been living here as an only registered monk.
Well, since today is Buddha's birthday in Korea, I want to ask, how do you mark the occasion at Hyunwasa Temple in Kingston upon Thames?
This is a very small family-like community oriented around, circling around the teaching of Buddha. Rely on your own physical, mental, emotional resource rather than dependent on other charity or hospitality. So all Buddha's birthday or all Buddhist congregation without any kind of financial gains.
I want to ask you more about that community surrounding you. For listeners who maybe don't know too much about Buddhism in Britain, what does the Buddhist community in the UK look like today, and just how popular is Buddhism?
Well, I must say, not only Buddhism, all kinds of traditional religions are not really popular. I dare say it's slowly just diminishing when it comes to the congregation. And Buddhism is not exception. So it's about a very small minority, I dare say.
Well, beyond the size of the community, I'd like to ask now about Buddhism's role in everyday life. Buddhism is often associated with a deeply religious practice, but many people also turn to meditation or to Buddhist teachings in more secular societies. What value do you think that Buddhism offers in places like the UK or modern day South Korea?
In this context, I think Buddhism can offer something to address all kinds of issues happening in global scale. I dare say Buddhism is rather scientifically addressing all kinds of human issues. Some people who are thinking, what am I doing here? What is the meaning of life? How can I really enjoy perennial, happy, physical health, and then emotional peace?
Well, let's talk a bit about your temple and its connection to Korean Buddhism more broadly. Can you explain how Yunhwasa Temple connects with other temples in the Jogye Order, both in Korea and around the world?
Well, we do not have any particular kind of regular interaction with Buddhist temple in Korea. But whenever I happen to be in my own mother temple, which is Chunhwansa Gangwon-do, spending 1.5 months, during which time I do my best to show what can you do of your own body, according to my own humble experience, and also giving some kind of formal Dharma talk. And then what is happening in the UK is I really rarely see interacting with other religious organizations like temples and then churches and mosques. Mm-hmm. And the other thing which I really enjoy is interacting with 3 to 11 primary school boys and girls belonging to a Church of England, Anglican Church. I remember last September, I spent half an hour in the meeting hall in the Church of England primary school with 230 or so boys and girls. Just a beautiful mingling, dancing together and chanting. What a wonderful feeling. This is my way of very small, minuscule contribution. What if someone adopt the way of Buddha's teaching could really enjoy being who you are, who she is, who he is?
Well, finally, on a more personal note, after years of teaching and giving talks and living as a monk, what is one lesson or piece of guidance that you would most like to share with our listeners today?
Today is a birthday party celebrating the most noblest, honored, beautiful, accomplished one, my own eternal mentor, the Enlightened One Buddha. Just kind of a gentle dialogue with your Buddha. You could shun away from very detrimental, quick fixing, fast fashion of human life, but more and more you try to use your own body, writing fountain pen on notepaper, rather than sticking to smartphone, mm-hmm. and then cooking food for yourself, and then chewing many and many times, full of gratitude, considering all this food, where they come from. And then visualizing millions and millions of living organisms cohabiting in my stomach or my body, full of joy. In this way, you are full of gratitude who you are, rather than searching something from outside. But look inside. Mm-hmm. That is called meditation. Mm-hmm. Either this is chanting meditation, or sitting meditation, or eye meditation. Whatever you do, inquiring, asking, is this the way making my body healthy, my mind bright, my emotion peaceful or not? Mm-hmm.
Well, we wish you and everyone celebrating a very peaceful Buddha's birthday. Jisu Sunim of Yunhwasa Temple in Kingston upon Thames, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your reflections.
I'm very honored to have this wonderful dialogue. Thank you very much. Happy Buddha's birthday.
We're wrapping up today's show with sounds from Sunday celebration at Jogye Temple in central Seoul. And from me and all the team, we wish everyone peace and harmony. That's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24. I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thank you for joining us. And until tomorrow, take care and goodbye.
KBS World Radio.